From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, in anticipation of the Oscars, we feature interviews from the archives with some of the great behind-the-camera talents. We'll hear from the inventor of the Steadicam, Garrett Brown. He tells us how he used his new invention to shoot sequences for Indiana Jones, Rocky, and The Shining. Actress Mercedes McCambridge was off-camera for one of her most unusual performances. She demonstrates how she created the voice of the devil for The Exorcist. Bug wrangler David Brody shares his adventures in bat caves, rounding up thousands of cockroaches for the film Creepshow. And sound designer Alan Splett explains how he created eerie sounds for David Lynch's Eraserhead and Blue Velvet. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Guarding Tess. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Bosnian Muslims and Croats have signed documents in Washington linking them together in a federation. President Clinton says the ceremony begins the difficult process of reconciliation in Bosnia. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Mr. Clinton called today's signing a moment of hope, but the federation is just the first step in a long road toward peace. President Clinton noted that Serbia, which controls two-thirds of Bosnia, is not included in the federation. Still, Bosnian President Aliha Izetbegovic, speaking through an interpreter, was optimistic.
This is a great day for Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Ali za sve protivnike mi rata I prijatelje mira.
But also to all those who are opposed to war and peace between people.
But to illustrate the difficulties in making peace in Bosnia, the president of the self-proclaimed Bosnian Serb parliament immediately called the federation an unnatural creation that will never work. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The United Nations is moving toward a plan, or rather a vote, on a resolution denouncing the Hebron Mosque massacre. It is supposed to come later this afternoon. Council members are talking behind closed doors to work out some disputes over language. Allies of the PLO want Jerusalem to be referred to as an occupied territory. They also want the resolution to ensure international protection for Palestinians in the West Bank. Both provisions could face a United States veto. The head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation is asking Congress for broad new wiretapping powers, but UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports FBI Director Louis Free got a chilly reception.
Free says the Ames spy case and the World Trade Center cases could not have been cracked without wiretapping. And he says wiretapping will be hard or impossible unless Congress rewrites the law to give police the power to control new telephone technology.
If there is no new statute, law enforcement will suffer. The cost to society will be staggering. Crime will claim untold victims who could otherwise have been preserved and protected.
But key members of Congress said what he wants would greatly invade privacy, cost billions, and cripple technology advances the economy needs. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee wants more American pressure on North Korea. Indiana Democrat Lee Hamilton has told NBC the White House should demand North Korea open its nuclear arms facilities to full inspections. He also says the U.S. and South Korea should go ahead with joint military exercises. French Nazi collaborator Paul Touvier has been formally charged with crimes against humanity. He's accused of killing seven Jews during World War II. Touvier is 78. He's the first Frenchman ever to be tried on this charge. On Wall Street, the Dow is up almost 16 points at 3,880. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq has fallen 2 points to 802. This is NPR. A report in Jane's Intelligence Review claims that Iran is getting close to collapse. A security specialist claims the Iranian economy is so bad that some hardships have already triggered riots. He predicts disturbances will grow. James Wiley says a weakening President Hashemi Rafsanjani continues to battle a fundamentalist group led by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, but he says neither is very popular, and he thinks Iran could be heading toward anarchy. Not all Middle Eastern experts agree. An editor of the Middle East Journal says Wiley's views are more like wishful thinking. Today, Secretary of Defense William Perry shook hands with his Russian counterpart on an agreement that provides millions of dollars to convert Russian defense plants to civilian use with the help of U.S. businesses. Brooke Gladstone has more from Moscow.
Today's agreement adds $20 million to the $20 million the U.S. has already committed to defense conversion in Russia. This money is to be used specifically as seed money to form partnerships between Russian defense firms and American businesses. One such partnership foreseen, Perry said, is that between several high-tech Russian defense firms and American companies for the production of personal computers. But he added that American businesses cannot rely on government funds but must commit their own money as well. Also today, the two sides signed off on another agreement with a $30 million price tag to help create a research institute in Moscow for the safe disposal of chemical weapons. Scientists here have criticized the government for poisoning the environment in a poorly planned effort to dismantle its chemical arsenal. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
Japan says it won't guarantee Japanese automakers' promises to import more American-made parts. The Minister of International Trade and Industry says Tokyo won't intervene in private sector agreements to increase imports. The minister says he instead favors dropping limits on Japanese auto exports to the United States. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Monday is Academy Awards night, so we have a movie show for you on this archive edition of Fresh Air. Our interviews are with some of the great behind-the-camera talents. In fact, our first guest has not only worked behind the camera, he invented the camera that has changed the way movies are shot. Garrett Brown won a 1977 Academy Award for technical achievement for his invention, the Steadicam. This is a portable camera with a specially designed harness that enables the camera operator to walk, run, climb, or leap and still get a stable, steady image. There are now many trained Steadicam operators, but in the early days, Brown had to shoot most of the Steadicam scenes himself. You've seen his work in such films as Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Return of the Jedi, Rocky, and The Shining. When I spoke with him in 1985, I asked what he had in mind when he dreamed up the Steadicam.
The problem is a handheld cameraman inevitably shakes the camera because human beings are always in motion, hopefully. The Steadicam deals with that problem by isolating the camera from the cameraman. This object that he's lugging around is actually held by a sort of mechanical arm, which is attached to a strange-looking suit that the cameraman wears. And the mechanical arm is like a spring sort of suspension system. It just tunes out all the bumps. And then the camera itself is arranged in a sort of fundamentally stable shape. It's basically, you know, lengthened and made taller and just made more inert. Sad to say, it's an invention that barely works, I must report. It takes a good operator. I mean, it's like saying the violin works to make wonderful music. In the early days, we peddled the Steadicam as if any bag lady could pick it up and make wonderful shots with it. It turns out that it takes a lot of practice and so on. So as inventions go, I wouldn't say it's a triumph of inventing. It's somehow a triumph of things that work with people, like the violin or the skateboard or the blood pressure measuring instrument, if you will.
What were some of the first sequences that you really tested the Steadicam for a movie?
Well, for a movie, I was thrown in headfirst, just, you know, hurled right into the water on Bound for Glory. My first shot on a feature involved 900 extras and a 46-acre set, and there I was up on a crane, you know, trembling out of just pure nervousness and funk, you know, looking around me. And fortunately, they didn't make the shot before lunch, and I had a couple of beers at lunch and calmed down a bit. But I remember the operator who was looking over my shoulder at the time and who is now a cameraman shooting a Spielberg film, and he and I were just talking about this. He said, "This thing must work," he says, "because you're shaken and the image is still, you know." And I'm sure he thought perhaps the way it worked is it made the cameraman shake. And, you know,
what were some of the typical requests that you got when the Steadicam was first available from directors who realized that the Steadicam could liberate them to achieve certain shots that would have taken weeks to set up beforehand?
Well, some realized it right away, and some saw it as a stunt tool. Some were quite happy with the conventional way of making films, and except for the shot like running after somebody or running up and down steps. My God, I did more than my share of shots running after people and leaping up stairs and jumping over gaps and things and impersonating rushing POVs, you know, and all that. And there were a few people, Avildsen among them, who saw more than that in it and who used it for liberating the process of filmmaking as much as liberating the shot, because the process involves a lot of paraphernalia, doesn't it? It involves all the laying down of rails and equipment and so on. And there are my favorite Steadicam shots are ones that on screen you wouldn't know the difference. You know, they are just a traveling camera. They involve putting the lens where somebody wants it, that's all. But you wouldn't look at it and say, oh, wow, what a shot. What you don't see behind the scenes is that shot was made in a flash, instantaneously. You walk in, you make it.
You shot the sequence on the rope bridge in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah, there's a case where, you know, that's the only way to get a camera moving out there that doesn't look terrible. I mean, a handheld guy, if he felt the way I did on that bridge, would have been quivering even more than normal.
Can you describe the scene and the shot that you were asked to do?
This bridge was built by a company that makes dams, and they're a pretty rough and ready outfit. They built a real suspension bridge, 350 feet in the air. Yes, it had steel cables inside the rope, you know, dressing cables, and it had boards on it that were allegedly very strong and so on, but there were big gaps between them. If you didn't walk with your feet straight ahead, your foot would go right down between the boards. So that implies also that you could see down between them, and that was not a treat. I can tell you to look, you know, down 350 feet as you're lurching on this thing, and it was violently in motion. Every time Harrison ran across it, it would lurch up and down a couple of feet. And he even actually went through one of the boards at one point, and there was a great hoo-ha and uproar and finger-pointing about who put that board in and didn't test it and so on. His leg went through it, and fortunately his other leg stopped him from the rest of him from going through. But that happened just before I went out to do my thing, so I had no great, you know, confidence in this bridge with me and my extra 50 pounds of machinery, you know. It was scary. And then when all the local extras dressed up as soldiers started to run, each of them lurching about, the thing was airborne, you know.
But how did you
hold on? It was hot,
by
the way. I held on with one hand and operated with the other. And my toes, I trained my toes to hang on to the boards. I mean, it was bad.
Doesn't that bridge get blown up, too?
Yes, I declined to be on the shot when it was blown up.
Are there scenes that you declined from because they're too dangerous?
No, very few. Usually everybody agrees generally, you know, what is too dangerous and what isn't. There have been very few. The only time I ever really made a fuss about anything was we had a shot potentially to walk up the cable of the Brooklyn Bridge for a film called Wolfen. And without inspecting the cable, and my memory of a bridge cable is it's the size of a truck and it shouldn't be any problem and so on, I said, well, all right, I'll do it, but we have to, I made some conditions. We've got to rehearse it for a day without the pressure of production. I want you to hire a mountain climbing type guy to go with me to be sure that I'm shackled and tied up right and so on. And I said, I'll try it. And due to the pressure of production, they couldn't lay on that extra day. So I said, well, okay, I will not walk up the cable and shoot. But in fact, I ended up walking up the thing anyway, holding the, you know, with the gear in a backpack, and we shot on top of the bridge. And I made very sure that everybody knew that the only way I would do that is if I was tied with a rope to a big iron ring that I spotted in the middle of the top of the bridge on a rope just short enough that I couldn't inadvertently go off the edge, because you get enthralled with shooting, and a gust of wind comes up, and bye-bye. Human and sewing machine, head for the drink, you know.
You also did the sequence in Return of the Jedi in the forest where these crazy creatures are driving one on some kind of motorized vehicle.
Speeder bikes.
Speeder bikes, yeah, like through the trees at amazing speed. And I kept wondering how you managed to do that.
Well, I trained and trained, and I managed to run 130 miles an hour just for short periods.
Did you really?
No.
No, okay.
No.
I'll believe anything.
Are you kidding? You've been in this business too long,
that's
Terry.
Right.
You've been told too many outrageous things by too many people. It's clear.
Okay, so now you can tell me how you really did it.
The way it was done was sort of a film trick. And actually, I loved this job. I had a wonderful time. First of all, I like the tough ones. I like advancing the art a little bit. And this was a first. I got a phone call. Do you think it's possible if you were to walk along with the camera running very slowly? The idea was maybe one frame every second, okay? Well, now, if you project that film at 24 frames a second, you have sped up what I did 24 times, clearly, okay? So 24 times 5 miles an hour walking speed, let's say, is, you know, 120 miles an hour. can it be held steady enough so that it won't look like it's vibrating and bounding around and so on? And my guess was yes. And the way it was done was quite a tour de force, really, because I had to walk through the redwoods about 1,000 yards carrying this thing, but the place that it was pointed couldn't deviate by a fraction of a degree from one side to the other, nor could its height, nor could its side-to-side position, nor could my speed, nor could its roll attitude. And the way we positioned it was we strung an invisible green thread through the woods and pulled it taut. And as I walked along, I just kept the camera within an inch or so of that thread, which is so tiny in the vast scene of all that you couldn't see it. And then I aimed the thing with a very long telephoto sort of sidefinder video camera. And I would aim it at a handkerchief or something 1,000 yards away and try and keep that in the lens with a very long lens. And now, of course, if that's still in there, then the overall angle hasn't changed much. But it was frighteningly precise work, because if I let the thing sink a foot, let's say it took 5 seconds for it to fall a foot, well, then there would be a third of a second severe bump in the shot once it sped up. So,
how many takes of that sequence did you do?
Well, we shot a lot of that. That was on, I think the sequence ran nearly 5 minutes. And I shot, of course, the background plates, so-called, and then the optical fellows matted in all the speeder bikes in the foreground. I supplied the backgrounds at high speed. And I think I must have made 14 or 15 shots in different places and probably did 3 or 4 takes apiece.
Some of the shots that you do have actors in them, and you might have to do some really tricky choreography. But it's up to the actors, too, to make sure that they've gotten the scene well performed, well gotten their lines right and everything. Have you ever wanted to strangle an actor because you did your part and you got through this really tricky, long shot and they didn't perform well in that scene, and because of that, you had to go through all that choreography all over again?
Well, I think with all due humility, I must point out that the actors are lumbered with the idea of having to do 3-minute scenes all through a set because I exist. And you can imagine the look of dismay on the face of actor or, you know, grip or anyone else in the set when somebody blows a line, or if I make a mistake 3 minutes in, I could cause him to have to do 3 minutes of giving his all and, the ultimate performance again because somebody wants it in one take, you know. And I'm not crazy about that, to be honest. I mean, to me, the cut is a noble institution. I love cuts. Audiences are used to them. I mean, I'd be happy to shoot all of it, but I like doing it in short pieces just like an actor does for the same reason. You can concentrate on the piece, make it perfect, you know. But when we all have to be spectacular for 3 minutes in a row, it's rough. Kubrick used to insist on numerous passes on shots like that ran 3 minutes. I mean, 50. Looking for some elusive, you know, chemistry that only he could see or appreciate, possibly.
Someone like Kubrick, I would imagine, would define to a hair how he'd want a shot framed.
Yeah, we'd have arguments about whether the crosshairs was on the center of the nose or slightly displaced in a wide shot, you know. All of us had elected to do the film, and all of us knew Stanley well enough to know that's what the game was, and all of us were quite willing in the hopes that he would get precisely what he wanted, and all of us, including Nicholson and everybody else. But there were times when it was a matter for consideration on another planet, whether the crosshair was here or here. I even once put a crosshairs made of tape on Shelley Duvall's nose and lined it up precisely with the crosshairs. For you folks out there who just see movies in the theater, the crosshairs are on the ground glass of the camera, and they indicate the center of the frame. Well, I lined up that crosshair with the fake one of gaffer's tape and held it very steadily, and then as the shot moved on, I moved mine away, and there were two in the frame, and hers always stayed right exactly where I wanted it. This is what you get into, and after take 40 in Great Britain in June when you're doing winter scenes that are supposedly taking place in Colorado.
So are people using less cliche shots now with the Steadicam? You said initially people would...
By far, yeah.
Yeah, people would call you up initially to run up and down stairs.
Yeah,
so
it's quite fun.
What are some of the calls you get now?
Well, I get called to do, let's see, for an example, I worked on Falling in Love. The shots were proceeding up the street, just ahead of Streep, in a place where if you made a big production out of it and laid rails and so on, it happened to be on Fifth Avenue right in front of the Trump Tower, you would draw crowds that would be unmanageable. So we basically popped out of the shadows and made the shot before anybody was quite aware of what we were doing. And I like that. I like using it that way. Sad to say, or good to say, there was another production on the same block with a Steadicam with another gentleman who's one of the living masters operating for on a Mickey Rooney movie. So their crowd control would release people just as we were trying to stop people, and it all got very comical. And then Sidney Lumet showed up and wheeled in and backed his truck up and stole a shot on our permits, and Cotton Club was shooting up the street in the commercial. It was like one of those days in New York where the whole world is a movie set. It was very funny. I even walked into the wrong camera truck. It was Teddy Churchill's truck who was doing the Mickey Rooney film.
It must be easy to lose perspective when you're surrounded by that many movies.
Fun also, though, because we always used to say there should be one of these on every corner Steadicam. So we're getting there. It's a fun machine. I don't know if I've ever really expressed this properly, but it is the operating a film is intriguing, as you can imagine. And the operator is quite a deep character. I mean, he has a lot more to do than simply point the thing. But operating the film and doing the athletic routine of Steadicam, in which you place it in space as well, is fascinating. It's just about my most favorite thing to do.
Garrett Brown recruited in 1985. He won an Academy Award in 1977 for his invention, the Steadicam. Mercedes McCambridge won a 1949 Academy Award for her performance in All the King's Men. But one of the performances she's now most famous for was off-camera. We'll talk about how she created the voice of the demon in The Exorcist after this break. This is Fresh Air. The vocal effects for the demon in the 1973 film The Exorcist weren't done with high-tech synthesizers and samplers. The satanic sounds came from the throat of actress Mercedes McCambridge. Back in 1981, she told me how she created the voice of the devil.
The Exorcist demon is a radio performance in a film.
Yeah, yeah.
It's 100% radio. But I had such a great teacher in college that I can go now from what is a rather high and thin and reedy tone of what I am doing all the way without any effort whatsoever down to the absolute coarseness of what I'm doing. And on back up without any problem whatsoever. Young actors are doing themselves a great disservice by not using the voice as much as they should as the best possible tool for communication. Everybody talks about projection. The hardest, the most difficult projection in the world is into this microphone. That's where the projection counts. The timbre has to be so much deeper than to use a voice full of stentorian tones in a theater reaching 5,000 people. That's nowhere near so difficult as coming down to the thing of trying to convey to someone, I love you. Do you know how much I love you. That's exciting. And it's all a funny little instrument inside us with a lot of timpani going in muted sounds.
Let's get back to The Exorcist. How did you figure out what the right speech would be and the wheezing sound that you
developed?
Yeah,
well, the speech was nothing. You know, and I read, reread, some of Kazantzakis' things about Lucifer. And I wanted to cry as Lucifer cried, but it's very hard to. We taped them on with 8 different microphones, with the people in the control room at Warner Brothers in this most sophisticated sound studio, and they would have them at different levels and the microphones open to various degrees or non-degrees of acceptance, and in one place I had to vomit. On the screen you see the green vomit from the girl's mouth, the bile, and it comes out in a projectile kind of way. Well, what it is pea soup with cornflakes in it. to make the bumps of vomit. Now, I had to make that sound. And the way I finally did it, and it was only through stumbling and invention, again, you know, as Stanislavski says, you utilize it, I would have them bring me apples, sections of apple, and I would put a whole bunch of those mushy apples in my mouth, and then from a Dixie cup, I would put in two eggs that had been just broken into the cup, not mixed up, just the yolk lying there looking at you, two of those, and at a signal from the control room when the frame of the film, which I was watching on the big screen in the empty sound studio, when it came up to the point where the little girl with the pea soup and the cornflakes coming out of tubes that were built up from the back of her bed and then around the outside of her cheeks and then her cheeks covered with makeup with spouts in her mouth, I had to time that precisely to the frame by swallowing these sections of apple, which were to be the lumps, and then the eggs down to mid-gullet, and then forcing the diaphragm muscles, and then throwing it up on eight microphones covered with a tarp. That's very hard. It's you have a hard time doing that. Again, Stanislavski says you can utilize anything that's ever happened to you. All my life I've wheezed, particularly when I was smoking, thank God. I don't know if I could play the demon in the same way now because I don't smoke anymore. But when I did, I wheezed a lot. And I didn't know how to get the breath of the demon across. And I wonder now if I can do it. Let's see, because my lungs have been cleared now of smoke for almost 3 years. So there isn't that awful bronchial hacking noise in there. But getting very close to the microphones, and it's hard to wheeze for any length of time. First of all, you have to wait until all of the air is out of the bellows of the lungs, and then you can maybe for a few seconds sustain it. But Blatty says in the book it had an unearthly sound, the devil's breathing, that could be heard through the open door. But if I get very close to the microphone, maybe I can do it. Well, that's very hard to do because you're gagging and you're forcing right down to the ultimate, the last breath that you have in your body. You do that for 5 or 10 minutes and you have to go lie down for a while and come back and do it again. Very exhausting.
There's a great story that you tell in your book that I'd love for you to tell us. Mm. It's about a radio drama you're doing with Boris Karloff, in which I guess he's a vampire and
of course
he sucks
he
your
vampire.
Blood. Yes.
Yeah.
and there's a great sound effect that I'd like you to
yeah,
tell us about.
We couldn't find anything. This gentleman, Boris Karloff, was the vampire who had broken my neck or would break my neck in the show and suck the blood. And he's standing on one side of the microphone going and everything, and I'm making anguished little noises on the other side, dying of the broken neck and the blood being sucked. But we couldn't find any sound that would really give the impression of the bones in the body or the neck breaking. And Tommy Horan, the sound man at NBC in Chicago, bought a whole sheaf, if that's the word, of spare ribs. And he had a cleaver, and he was pounding at these spare ribs, and they were flying off like pterodactyls' toenails into the corners of the studio. Just really awful. But it wasn't the sound that it should be. So then in one of the drawers of his utility table, he found some peppermint lifesavers. And he put a peppermint lifesaver, I wish I had one now, on end between his back teeth and got very close to his microphone, the sound microphone, and crunched. And you'd hear these little bits, these little flakes of peppermint lifesaver being disintegrated. And it sounded like every small bone in the neck was being split. It was just great. So he was over there doing that with his mastication. And I'm groaning. And Boris is going, oh, it was sensational. But it was just a lifesaver.
That's such a great story.
Yeah, yeah. In radio, we had them like that.
That's Mercedes McCambridge, recorded in 1981. I can't resist. I'll try an experiment. I've got a Tic Tac. See how it sounds. Not really scary, is it, huh? No. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More movie interviews from our archives in the second part of the show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue this archive edition of Fresh Air, and it will give you the creeps. Sound designer Alan Splett tells us about creating the eerie sounds for David Lynch's movies Eraserhead and Blue Velvet. And we hear the adventures of bug wrangler Dave Brody. His movie assignments have included rounding up 22,000 cockroaches for the film Creepshow. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Guarding Tess, which teams up Shirley MacLaine and Nicolas Cage. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The UN Security Council has begun voting on portions of a draft resolution that strongly condemns the massacre of Palestinians in Hebron. The vote, which was delayed because of prolonged negotiations between the United States and the Palestinians, comes more than 3 weeks after the massacre. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The draft resolution is not entirely to Washington's liking. Among other things, it contains a reference to Jerusalem as being part of the Israeli-occupied territories, language that the U.S. finds objectionable. Washington argues it's not up to the Council to determine Jerusalem's status, that the issue should be worked out by Israel and the Palestinians. However, it appears that Washington will allow the resolution to be adopted in an effort to get the stalled Middle East peace talks moving again. Some diplomats say a strong condemnation by the Council, combined with a call for greater security guarantees for Palestinians in the occupied territories, may strengthen PLO leader Yasser Arafat's political position and allow him to resume negotiations with Israel. However, as of now, Arafat has made no firm commitment to return to the negotiating table. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
A South African judicial commission says it has evidence that senior South African police supplied weapons to the Inkatha Freedom Party. Another allegation indicates the police trained hit squads to create political instability. The number two officer in the South African police force has been implicated. The African National Congress has long charged that the government has supported Inkatha in the political violence between the ANC and Inkatha. Over the past 3 years, this undermines South African President F.W. de Klerk's contention that his government has not participated in any violence. The space shuttle Columbia returned to Earth today. The second longest shuttle mission ended with a touchdown at Florida's Cape Canaveral. The longest shuttle flight was only 57 minutes longer than today's. Columbia was launched March 4th with 11 primary experiments worth nearly $100 million. Most of them were commanded by remote control from the ground. Many of the studies were intended to help build an international space station in orbit at the end of the century. The U.S. Figure Skating Association has tentatively decided to go ahead with a disciplinary hearing for skater Tanya Harding. The association's executive committee has discussed her case, and the association's president says the group talked about what they should do if the skater ever applies for reinstatement. Harding was forced to resign from the Skating Association as part of her plea agreement this week. She's pleaded guilty to obstructing the investigation of the attack on skater Nancy Kerrigan. The association is also talking about stripping Harding of her 1994 National Skating Championship. The stock market closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 30 points, ending at 3,895. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. Bosnian Croat and Muslim leaders have signed documents creating a federation intended to govern the territory they hold and to end the war between them. Presiding over the signing ceremony at the White House, President Clinton said the participants were bearing witness to hope for peace, but peace will be a reality only if the people of Bosnia make it so.
Economic, political, and security arrangements for the new federation must be given a chance to work. The ceasefire between Croats and Bosnian government forces must hold. Croats and Muslims who have fought with such intensity must now apply that same intensity to restoring habits of tolerance and coexistence.
Mr. Clinton also says he hopes the Serbs will join the peace process. In Belgrade, there's been no formal Serbian reaction to the new confederation. We have more from the BBC's Paul Adams.
At best, the agreement signed today marks the beginning of a process by which the battle-weary people of the former Yugoslavia return to the idea of living together. At worst, it represents a shifting of alliances and the start of a new phase of the war. It's still too early to know down which path Bosnia is heading. A year of ferocious fighting between Muslims and Croats has not sown the seeds of tolerance and understanding. On the other hand, the temptation to turn the Federation into an alliance intent on settling scores with the Serbs must be considerable. But there are hopeful signs. Much depends on how determined Washington is to see it come to fruition. The Russians, meanwhile, have concentrated on involving the Serbs in the peace process. Next week's meeting in Zagreb between the Croatian government and representatives of the breakaway Serb areas of Croatia is a vital first step.
Paul Adams reporting. South Korea wants to resume joint military maneuvers with the United States. The move would be in retaliation for North Korea's failure to cooperate with international nuclear weapons inspectors. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Academy Awards are Monday. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring some great behind-the-camera talent. Alan Splett won an Academy Award for his sound work on the 1979 film Black Stallion. Splett is a sound designer with a gift for mixing natural sounds to create new sounds that don't quite exist in the real world. I spoke with him in 1987 about designing the sound for the David Lynch films Eraserhead and Blue Velvet. Let's talk about your film, Eraserhead, which is a cult classic now. The movie's like a bad dream about urban life where everything is rancid. It's
right.
A real bleak
right.
movie. Now, you created a psychological sound environment for that, and in the background, there's this constant, vaguely industrial sound. Let's play a little bit of it.
Okay.
Remind ourselves of how it sounded. What was the psychological effect you were trying to achieve with the background sound?
Essentially, it's just a sort of surreal urban environment that's always, like, pervasive and omnipresent, in a sense.
The sounds in it don't sound exactly like anything I've ever heard before, but it sounds industrial to me. Did you take familiar sounds and make them into this unfamiliar pattern?
We had an old gas heater in the editing room where I was working. It was just which had a big metal case on it. So one day we stuck a microphone down in the bottom of it, a little tiny microphone in the bottom of this thing, and David was blowing into the top of it, and we just got a lot of really strange sounds that way. And another time we floated an old water cooler bottle. Remember the big 5-gallon bottles when they used to be glass? Now they're plastic. We floated that in a bathtub and stuck a microphone inside that and got a really ethereal type of bubbly sound. So we basically made all the sounds ourselves, but they all had organic roots. They weren't, nothing was created electronically. And I think that's one reason why it has the presence that it does, because they are real sounds, even though they've been changed.
I want to take you to another movie that you did with David Lynch, Blue Velvet.
Yes.
There's a scene in Blue Velvet where the hero, who's from a small town, has become involved with a woman who represents all his darkest sexual fantasies. And they're making love, and she says to him, "Hurt me, hit me." And she said that before, and he's refused to do it. But now he does it. He hits her. He hits her
yeah.
hard. Let's play that and hear how it sounds.
Okay.
Hit me!
No! No!
Get away! Get away from that bed! Get away!
That's certainly a smack that reverberates. How did you get it? Was that just a regular slap across somebody's face?
No, we tried that. One of the fellas, my assistant, is a pretty strapping guy, and we tried slapping him on the back. We tried all sorts of stuff like that, and that didn't work. But we were over at a friend's house one day doing some recording, some just odd sound effects, and he happened to have a pumpkin on the floor. So we just, it was just one of those sort of lucky accidents. We took the pumpkin and we started, first we hit it with our hands, and then we found a metal ruler on his desk, and we started slapping it with a metal ruler.
Now, what would have been wrong with just a regular slap? It's not convincing enough?
It's interesting that when you hear it with your ear, of course it sounds convincing, but it when you record it with the microphone, it just loses. It just, there's something lost there. It doesn't have, I don't know, it's hard to describe. Just psychologically, it doesn't convey enough energy. I can't quite tell you why. It's just funny. We all thought that a slapping someone hard on the back, for instance, would do it. But it just didn't have enough starch.
Sound designer Alan Splett recorded in 1987. So is this convincing? Ouch. Ouch. Coming up, going to the bat caves of Trinidad to round up roaches for a creepy film. First a break. This is Fresh Air. Our next movie guest doesn't get to work much with actors. He deals with insects. And in the movie Creepshow, he rounded up a cast of thousands so that E.G. Marshall could be overcome by roaches.
Once you get bugs, you never get rid of them. Breed in the crawl spaces, in the conduits, in the very core of the building itself.
In the film Creepshow, E.G. Marshall played a millionaire Howard Hughes-type hermit whose germ-free penthouse was mysteriously infested by cockroaches. These cockroaches were supplied and handled by entomologist David Brody. In Hollywood parlance, he's known as a bug wrangler. In The Believers, he worked with tarantulas and centipedes. But his tour de force was directing more than 22,000 cockroaches for Creepshow. I asked David Brody how he rounded up all those bugs, including 2,000 giant roaches from Trinidad.
I made some calls to Washington, and I found out that if I was very careful, I can import the giant cave roach from Trinidad. They flew us to Trinidad, and you would sit on the floor of the cave, and the cave floor was covered in bat guano, bat droppings. Now, because the cave was dry, these droppings had the consistency of coffee beans. You would sit down on the floor with your legs crossed, and the ground, the coffee beans would undulate because beneath them were the roaches. And we got about two-thirds of the roaches that we needed out of that. And then we went down to the lower cave, and that was a very wet cave, very disturbing cave because it was narrow and constricting. And there was one point within that cave where you really had to wiggle through. And that's when the bats left that cave, they made a slight drop in their flight path, and that's where they defecated. So you had water dripping there. Now, coming out of the cave after collecting the roaches, my hand sort of slipped into that morass, and I wanted to amputate my hand at that point. It was very, very unpleasant.
How did you survive this experience?
Well, I'm a naturalist, and anything alive is sort of grist for our mill. We just love living things, love being around them, love being in the tropics, and we survive pretty adequately.
How do you bring them on the airplane with
you
to get them back to the States?
We pack them in egg cartons and then light plywood boxes. All this was constructed here in the States and brought to Trinidad with us. We landed at Kennedy. The USDA people, of course, were there. And once we told them what we had, they really didn't want to have any part of them. They sort of peeked in. We offered to open the boxes, and of course, they said no, 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 no. And we got through with them. From there, we flew on to Pittsburgh with them, where the actual filming was. And they had a huge trailer for us, which we, of course, dubbed the Roach Motel. And now, the other roaches were laboratory bred at biological supply houses around the country. And that's where approximately 20,000 American roaches came into the act.
The name that you're given when you work on a movie is Roach Wrangler or Tarantula Wrangler.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the word wrangler used for
that's a movie term. Horse wranglers, cow wranglers, and that sort of just trickled down. But I think it's a good term. I think it's exactly what we do.
How do you control roaches on a set? If they're actors, you tell them what their positions are, and you yell positions, and everything's all set. How do the roaches know where their positions are?
You build corrals for them, and you give the impression that they're doing things. And you can get them to move in directions by air current, by light. The very things that govern their lives, essentially, is how we use them. The scenes where they're coming up out of the sink were done with giant plastic syringes, and we just sort of pumped them in. My favorite scene in that movie was, of course, the bed scene, when he flips the covers off the bed, and the whole bed is just covered with a mass of undulating roaches. I thought that was just really terrific.
I thought that was pretty scary myself, and this is still all in Creepshow that you're talking about.
Right.
Is there any way to knock out roaches
so you
can put them to sleep for a while?
We did that a lot. We used CO2 gas, and you put roaches in giant plastic bags, and you pump in CO2 gas, and they slowly come awake. And depending on how much gas you give them, you can regulate that to some degree.
Have you been involved in scenes where an actor or actress couldn't cope with the insects on the set?
Never. Never. Never happened.
Do you do little consciousness-raising sessions beforehand to tell them the real story of the insects they're going to be working with?
I've never had to do that. It's interesting. When I worked on Creepshow with E.G. Marshall, here we had all these roaches, and I believe it was in his contract that no roaches were to be on him. But it turned out that his son is a naturalist and travels all over the world catching bizarre insects and spiders and everything else. So he was pretty well acquainted with them, and he had fun with the role and fun with the insects. We had them on his sleeves, and there was no problem.
One of my concerns would be, if I were doing a movie like this, is what happens to the roaches after the shoot? You have 22,000 roaches running around a set. I mean, who'd want 22,000 roaches not only in the set but added to the city that it's being filmed in? Is there any way to ensure that you can gather them all up and control them when you're finished?
Well, the government regulations that I had with the permit stated that all the imported roaches had to be frozen and then burned, which is what we did. It was a wonderful job, by the way. It wasn't one that I was particularly happy to do. I don't like to kill animals, I really don't, but it was the only way. We just had too many of them to deal with.
Well, one of the most shocking moments in recent entertainment television was when the magicians Penn and Teller appeared on the David Letterman show, and Letterman said, "I want you to really surprise me." So Teller put his magician's hat on Letterman's desk, then lifted it up a little bit later to reveal hundreds of roaches, which immediately took over Letterman's desk. Letterman was absolutely horrified, or at least that's how
he sure was.
He appeared to be. Now, you were the wrangler that Penn and Teller used to get those roaches. When they called you up and asked you to surprise David Letterman live on television, what did you think of the idea?
Well, it was a matter of getting Penn and Teller to learn to handle the insects, and they did that pretty well. When it came to the final roundup, they just pitched in and helped. They helped me scoop them up, which says a lot for Penn and Teller. And we got them all back, except for one, which showed up the next night when Julia Child was doing some cooking, I understand. I thought that was rather amusing.
So you're sure you got all of them except for one?
Well, we hope so.
You like and respect insects. And in some of the movies, like Creepshow, viewers end up getting so repulsed by the insects, in part because there's so many of them swarming all over. Do you ever feel like you're reinforcing our fear and hatred of the bugs that you respect?
Well, of course, that's what you're doing. But there's very little hope for the urban person. The urban person doesn't know what insects do, doesn't get out and see what they're capable of, doesn't see their beauty. I get a tremendous kick out of walking along the right-of-way of the Long Island Railroad tracks and looking at the plants and looking at the insects and looking at what the insects are doing. And it's something that it's hard to turn that into words, and the absolute fascination that's there. And the everyday insects, like a ladybug feeding on an aphid, which is what ladybugs do, and that's why they're so valuable, or a milkweed bug, which is brilliantly colored to warn other insects that it's not very palatable. These are everyday things, and they're just so wonderful, and the average person doesn't really know or really care, the urban person. They don't have the time or the inclination to really delve into that. And that's basically what my life revolves around. It revolves around living things and seeing this beauty and this wonder all the time.
David Brody, I want to thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bug wrangler David Brody, recorded in 1987. This is Fresh Air. Muslims and Croats signed their federation agreement today in Washington. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on All Things Considered?
We covered the event, Terry, and we will also have a substantial conversation about the turns that U.S. policy in Bosnia has taken with a former ambassador who has since left the State Department. Also, a conversation with Lonnie Guinier. She has written a book to explain her views on race. And a report from South Africa that the South African police have helped to arm and train hit squads for the Inkatha Freedom Party. Also, Ronald Reagan is angry with Oliver North. He's written a letter which could affect the Virginia Senate campaign.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Hugh Wilson made his reputation inventing TV series like WKRP in Cincinnati and the famous Teddy Z. In the film business, he made a killing by creating the low-rent but highly profitable Police Academy series. With his new movie, he seems to be breaking into a higher-rent district. Guarding Tess stars Nicolas Cage and Shirley MacLaine. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
It probably sounded good on paper, sort of Driving Miss Daisy meets The Bodyguard. In Guarding Tess, Nicolas Cage plays Secret Service agent Doug Chesnick, who's been saddled with an unusual assignment. He has to hang out in a small Ohio town, standing watch over former First Lady Tess Carlisle, played by Shirley MacLaine. It turns out to be the toughest job of Doug's career. Even though the public adores her, the private Tess is something of a terror. She enjoys using Doug and the other Secret Service agents as glorified maids, making them fetch her breakfast in bed, or trundling them along for a solitary golf game in the dead of winter. And Doug, who's a stickler for rules and regulations, goes ballistic when Tess orders her chauffeur, Earl, to drive her off for a day in the country, without the palace guard.
Did you enjoy yourself today?
Don't take that tone with me, Douglas.
Look, this is just stupid, okay?
Which part? The part where I have to run away like a fugitive in order to have 1 hour's worth of privacy? Or the part where I am spoken to like a child?
I fired Earl. This has happened twice now.
No.
He is a driver in the employ of the Secret Service. I can't do anything about the cook or the nurse. No, they work for you. But this guy works for us, and he's gone!
He works for you because I told you people to hire him. He's my chauffeur.
And he's staying!
For a while, all of this is pleasant enough. Nicolas Cage looks suitably doleful and scared when the President of the United States calls and tells him that if he doesn't keep Tess happy, he'll find himself guarding the White House dog. And Shirley MacLaine does yet another variation on the crusty but lovable battle axe routine she's been trotting out every couple of years since Terms of Endearment. The movie burbles along, mildly funny, mildly engaging, never very surprising. But less than halfway through, it quite visibly runs out of steam altogether. And you can see writer-director Hugh Wilson getting desperate. First, he brings on a venal son who visits Tess, asks her for money, and then disappears for the rest of the picture. Then there's a life-threatening illness that's waved in our face and immediately forgotten, apparently without consequence. Finally, there's a kidnapping of all things. And Doug has to rescue Tess and prove how much he's grown to love her. At which point the music goes urgent and syrupy, and FBI agents start pouring from helicopters, and you realize the movie has jumped the tracks. What began as a sleepy little comedy has become an even sleepier crime melodrama. And finally, a downright soporific tearjerker. We may be used to this sort of thing by now. TV sitcoms have trained us to watch jokey stories go all maudlin and earnest at the end. Still, that doesn't make it any more palatable. This movie leaves a sour taste in the mouth. By trying to milk terror and tears from us in its second half, Guarding Tess wipes out all the goodwill it's earned along the way.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker.
Spring is here.
has got me feeling like a horse that never left the post. I lie in my room staring up at the ceiling. Spring can really hang you up the most.
Sunday is the first day of spring. Many songs have been written to celebrate the season, but one of my favorite spring songs is the melancholy ballad we're listening to now, Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most. And this version by Betty Carter may be the definitive recording of the song. The music was written by Tommy Wolfe. The lyrics are by Fran Lansman. She was part of a circle of beat writers and jazz musicians when she started writing songs in the 50s. In 1988, Fran Lansman told me why she wrote Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most.
I wrote that song because I was enamored of T.S. Eliot's poem, which begins, April is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire, breeding lilacs out of the deadland. And I was thinking to myself, if a hipster were going to say that, he would say, spring can really hang you up the most, man. And I told that to this piano player, Tommy Wolfe, and he said, that would make a good song. Why don't you try to write it? And I said, I've never written a song. He said, oh, go ahead and try. So I brought this lyric into him, and he put that beautiful, beautiful music to it.
All is alone. The party's over. Old man went to woods. A precious heart.
Betty Carter, here's hoping you find this spring more cheerful than this song. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a former white supremacist tells us why he left the movement. Floyd Cochran was a national spokesman and recruiter for the Aryan Nation. Since leaving the group 2 years ago, he's devoted himself to speaking out against the racist ideology he used to promote. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.